Studios. This is ABQ Connect with Jim Williams.
Welcome to ABQ Connect, presented by Bosky Heating and Cooling. They also provide plumbing, roofing, and restoration services. Give them a call at 444-7200 if you need service. Bosky Heating and Cooling, locally grown, locally owned. It's my pleasure to welcome author Ace Collins to our show today. He has written over 99 books with over 2.5 million copies sold. That's a happy problem. And 20 different publishers. And you'll be interested to know he writes a lot about Christmas music. He's written a book here this past year about hymns. We're going to be talking about a book that originally was released in 2001. It's called Stories Behind the Best Loved Songs of Christmas, and it was recently, a new edition was just recently released. Ace Collins, welcome to ABQ Connect.
What a joy to be back with you. Of course, this is my first time with you, Jim, but I'm kind of familiar with the station and with your audience. So it's great to be back out in the Southwest.
Well, and we're happy to have you on the show, especially just knowing, getting to know you a little bit. You're a basketball guy, a former basketball player and announcer, and I have a similar background to that. But I will tell you, Ace, that I do not have the background of writing 99 books, and I find it really interesting that you write action-adventure books that are fiction, and then you write books about music and songs. And I just want our listeners to know a few of those. Stories Behind the Great Traditions of Christmas Music, October 16th, 2018. How do you choose the topics for what you write about?
To a large degree, the Stories Behind the Best-Loved Songs of Christmas, which we're going to be talking about today, was a book that I came up with an idea on 10 years before it sold. It was rejected 27 times and eventually found a publisher that wanted it. And of course, it ended up, you know, selling over a million copies, hit number 3 overall on Amazon.com. I mean, it just went crazy, but nobody believed in it for 10 years. And I had to have two other books on stories behind songs before somebody would take a chance on that first Christmas book. And that led to 12 or 13 other Christmas books, including 3 novels. And I've had a blast being what HarperCollins jokingly calls me, Doc Holliday. I really do enjoy knowing all of this. And it's led me to really get some bucket list things done. I mean, I've been interviewed by everything from the Wall Street Journal to the BBC to New York Times and Washington Post and the CBC, Canadian Broadcasting Company, and others across the globe, and they're all places I wanted to land at one time or another and never figured I would. And then, you know, and the Smithsonian uses me. So being kind of the guy who knows everything, or knows a great deal anyway, about the stories behind Christmas songs and Christmas traditions that's a nice thing to have, because every year you know that when it comes around to November and December, you're going to be sitting at home in your office talking to people all over the globe about Christmas. And I think this year with COVID and everything else, it's more important than ever, because people aren't going to have a traditional Christmas, probably the least traditional Christmas we've had since World War II. Mm-hmm. When we were separated for 3 or 4 years, you know, this is ultimately only going to be 1 year by the time the vaccine gets injected and everything else. We're probably going to be normal again next year. But, you know, it did put in perspective for me, a guy who was born well after World War II, what it must have been like during World War II and why White Christmas and I'll Be Home for Christmas and Have Yourself a Merry Little Christmas and the Christmas song by Nat King Cole that Mel Torme wrote were so important to those people during that time. They clung to those songs, hoping and praying that they would have a Christmas when everybody was back together again. And if they could make it through those 3.5, 4 years of World War II, which my grandfather did, and he came home to meet a daughter who was 2 years old that he had never seen before. Or if you go to Great Britain, those people went through that for 6 years, many, many times without getting home. If they can go through that, then we can make it through what we're making it through this year.
Absolutely love those words of hope, and getting out of 2020 is an amazing. Ace, as you talk about songs, a lot of these are old songs. I'm one of those people, I don't know if I really know the lyrics to many of these songs, but I know the melodies and I hear the songs, but I don't know if I've ever really listened. And in preparing for our interview today, I've kind of listened to some of the lyrics, and for you to know the background and why those lyrics were written, I think our listeners are going to be fascinated. So let's get right to it. I mean, let's talk about a song like God Rest Ye Merry Gentlemen. I don't know any other words to that song, but I know that there is a fascinating background to that, the history of that song.
Yeah, and it got written, God Rest You Merry Little Gentlemen, Let Nothing You Dismay, Remember Christ Your Savior Was Born on Christmas Day. Written about 600 years ago in England, may have been a few decades before that even. Written by a peasant. Now, many people do not know that Christmas carols, if you're not Catholic and you're not Lutheran, most Protestant churches did not celebrate Christmas until about 1840, 1850. So songs were not sung or written by Protestants during that time. It was the Lutherans were the only Protestant denomination that really had an impact on Christmas. So mainly these are old Catholic songs. And so when it wasn't in church, you had peasants writing them. And this was a peasant who wrote this song 600 years ago. The thing that's most fascinating to me is the British do not say Merry Christmas. They say Happy Christmas. And this song is part of the reason. Whereas Merry has always meant happy in the United States. If you go back 700, 800 years, Merry had multiple meanings in Great Britain. When you think about Robin Hood and his merry men, it mm-hmm. didn't mean they were happy guys out in the forest living in the trees while fighting off a tyrannical king. Okay? They weren't that happy. They were mighty men who were fighting that tyrannical mm-hmm. king. And therefore, the word merry means great or mighty. When they say Merry Old England, it was the most powerful country in the world. Hence, in the Middle Ages, by the way, you were happy if you had money and you had wealth. It was a pretty miserable lot in life if you were a peasant. Yes, you found happiness where you could, but it was a struggle just to live.
Yes.
And therefore, when they use the word merry, it meant great. The word rest in that old English song meant make or keep. So we probably should be singing that song, God keep you merry, gentlemen, mm-hmm. instead of rest you merry gentlemen. And then we probably should substitute mighty for merry. And so if you want to think about it this year, sing these lyrics. God make you mighty, gentlemen, let nothing you dismay. And it totally changes the whole meaning of Christmas. The BBC asked me from time to time, why do we say Merry Christmas? And I asked them, why do they say Happy Christmas? They don't actually know, because it's been lost in time. But it's because Mary had multiple meanings 600-700 years ago. So naturally, if you want to emphasize having a joyful Christmas, you use the word happy. And yes. So that, by the way, was the very first song that I ever went back and did the story behind, because as a kid, it always confused me that why would God want happy people to sleep?
Yes.
I mean, that's what that sounds like. And yeah. So, you know, that's one of the songs. The oldest song, by the way, that we still sing in at least part is Gloria in Excelsis Deus. Mm-hmm. There was a church leader in 130 AD that said, whenever the second chapter of Luke is read, everyone in the congregation should sing Gloria. Mm-hmm. And I find that fascinating, because the church did not begin to celebrate Christmas till about 330 AD. It was not a formal celebration before that. So that song was being sung 200 years before we formally had a Christmas holiday or Christmas events in the church. The second oldest song that we still sing, the carol, is O Come Emmanuel, known as the Seven O's, because each verse of those seven verses begins with O. And that song dates back to about 900 AD. And if you listen to it closely, it's really easy to imagine a bunch of Catholic monks in a little monastery somewhere with their voices in harmony echoing off the wall singing that song. So those are our two oldest Christmas carols that we still sing to this day.
I know this is going to sound naive, but I need you to tell me the difference between a song and a carol.
I think the way it's probably defined by most people is a carol is a song with religious impact. Therefore, it is a song based on the story that is in the Bible. So when you look at Angels We Have Heard on High, Silent Night, those songs, those are carols. No matter if they're old or they're new. And Silent Night is only 202 years old, so it's not an old carol by any stretch of the imagination. But when you look at White Christmas, I'll Be Home for Christmas, Blue Christmas, those are songs. Mm-hmm. Those are, you know, kind of embrace Christmas as a secular holiday. So I think the difference is in whether it has a secular impact or an impact of a sacred impact. And the carols really are more about the worship of Christ, whereas songs are more about the celebration of the holidays in general.
Yes. You know,
and it's interesting to me, back in my grandmother, who survived the Depression with her 10 kids and her husband, kept every Christmas card that she was ever sent. And 80 to 90% of the cards that she was sent in the 1930s and 1940s, clear up to the 1950s, did not have Merry Christmas or Happy Christmas. They had season's greetings or Happy Holidays written on them. And so those were the terms that were used throughout the 30s and 40s. And I think they were used as much as anything else because people didn't see each other very much. So if you were getting a Christmas card, it was probably also, you know, wishing you to have a happy new year as well. And so, you know, you covered all your bases when you sent your Christmas cards out then. Yes, there were a few that said Merry Christmas, but most of them said season's greetings or Happy Holidays back then.
Is there a songwriter that was particularly made a big impression on you that used to write songs? I know you mentioned in your bio a little bit about Mark Lowry and songs like Mary, Did You Know?
Yeah, and I think there's, you know, everybody wants that Christmas hit. If you think about it now, it makes a songwriter and it also makes the artist that gets linked to that song kind of immortal. We can't imagine being Crosby not coming back to us each and every Christmas. The same thing is true of Perry Como, Elvis Presley to a lesser degree because Elvis's music is still played so much. But if you think about Perry Como and you think about Bing Crosby, they're known for their Christmas songs now. You know, Crosby and Como had scores of top 10 hits, a lot of number ones. But we don't remember or listen much to Bing Crosby's songs other than White Christmas, I'll Be Home for Christmas, and Silver Bells, which were three massive hits for him. And therefore, it's kind of made him immortal. The songwriter who's probably most attached to Christmas, even though very few people know he wrote the songs, is a guy named Johnny Marks. And Johnny Marks was the guy who was behind Rudolph the Red-Nosed Reindeer, Holly Jolly Christmas, and Rockin' Around the Christmas Tree. And those are three monster hits that we wouldn't have if we didn't have a tunesmith named Johnny Marks who constantly was coming up with new ideas for Christmas songs. And so, you know, it's kind of everybody wants one hit. Marks had three. And that's a pretty amazing accomplishment, you know, as opposed to a guy named Smith who was dying of cancer back, tuberculosis back in the 30s. And the last song he wrote became a hit after he died, and it has been attached to Christmas ever since, and that's Winter Wonderland. And so even though he died in his 30s of that horrible disease, a part of him lives on each and every Christmas when we hear Winter Wonderland again. By the way, going back on that concept of immortality in Christmas music, Dinah Shore, who a lot of our listeners will not know, charted more than 400 times and was one of the most popular singers of the 30s, 40s, and early 50s. Mm-hmm. But she never had a Christmas hit, so we never hear her music anymore. Having a Christmas hit does ensure you of being remembered for generations after that hit, after all your other hits have been dismissed. I think Mariah Carey's I'll Be Home for Christmas will still be listened to 50 and 60 years from now. Mm-hmm. I'm not sure we'll be listening to any of the other Mariah Carey hits 50 or 60 years from now, but that Christmas song is going to endure.
Is there somebody that's been writing songs recently, maybe let's say in the last 5 years, that's become pretty popular with a Christmas song?
Not that I know of, and I think the reason for that is you have some hits that emerge at Christmas that go away a Christmas or two later. I think it takes 20 or 30 years to fully determine if a song is going to have staying power. I mentioned the four that were released in World War II, and the stories behind each of those songs is kind of fascinating. But if you think about it, it's songs that were released when we were going through tough times that seem to have that staying power. You know, with carols, yeah, there have been tens of thousands of carols written over the years, but there's only about 40 or 50 that we actually continue to sing. Why some last and others don't, I don't know. Let's take Silent Night as a classic example. 1818, a Catholic priest who's 25 years old, young man, Joseph Moore is his name. He's in Oberndorf, Austria. This is the first time he's ever prepared a Christmas Eve service that he has been in charge of. He gets to the church and the organ doesn't work. He's in a panic. He has wrapped his entire service around choral music with the organ accompanying it. He runs over to a friend of his house, Franz Gruber, who's a school teacher, and said, "Franz, what are we going to do?" And Franz volunteers to play the guitar with the music. The problem is the music doesn't fit with the guitar that has been picked out. And that's when Franz makes a second suggestion. Why don't we write something? Well, 2 years before, in 1816, this priest, Joseph Moore, had written a poem about walking through the woods on Christmas Eve. Mm-hmm. He went back and got that poem that was inspired by that walk. They set it to music. They taught it to the choir. And that night, Silent Night, or in the original language, Stille Nacht, Heilige Nacht, became the song that saved Christmas in Oberndorf, Austria, at least in this church. Well, 3 weeks later, a man had to come by and fix the organ. And the guy who fixed the organ said, "What did you do for music on Christmas Eve?" The priest picked up his own guitar and played the song for him. That man wrote down the lyrics, learned the melody, and then left. 30 years later, Joseph Moore, the priest, who has almost forgotten about that night and that song, is walking through a large city in Germany and hears Silent Night coming from a cathedral being sung by a choir. He rushes in to find out how they know his song, and he eventually finds out that the man who fixed the organ became the Johnny Appleseed of Silent Night and took that song everywhere he went and taught it to every church and school he fixed organs at. By the time the priest found out that song was still known, it had been translated into 20 different languages and was the most powerful and popular carol in the United States. It has been sung more than any other Christmas song. White Christmas is the best-selling song of all time, but no song has come close to being sung as many times as Silent Night. What's amazing is it was supposed to be sung only once, and it was supposed to be used as a stopgap measure only to save one service. Another remarkable fact about that song, what was the name of that church in Oberndorf, Austria? St. Nicholas.
I love it. How do you put all these facts together? Does this take years of research, or is this stuff that you've now put together and just know it? And each one of these things, each book that you write, I know that we're going to talk in a minute about some of the stories behind the great traditions of Christmas, released in October of 2018. Stay with us on ABQ Connect.
Whether ordering delivery, takeout, or pickup, let's get out there and support our favorite restaurants. Central Grill and Coffee House, east of Rio Grande on Central, serving breakfast all day. Casa Taco, uniquely prepared craft tacos made fresh to order. Nacho Mama's Tacos. Grassburger, using 100% grass-fed beef. EatGrassburger.com. Village Pizza, two locations. Great homemade pizza, the best ingredients. They need us, and truth be told, we need them. Bon appetit.
Gonstead Physical Medicine specializes in the diagnosis and treatment of spinal ligament injury, pain in your back, neck, shoulders, arms, and legs, as well as numbness in your extremities. Dizziness and bladder or bowel issues can all be symptoms. 90% of doctors treating spinal ligament injuries don't know how to determine the severity and location of this condition. At Gonstead Physical Medicine, all of the providers are trained to do this. Schedule a consultation today at gonstead-nm.com or 505-884-8584.
At Albuquerque Christian Children's Home, we believe that children are truly a gift from God. That's why we open our arms and our hearts to children who have been abused, neglected, or abandoned. Children who are hurting and scared. Although we have lots of love to give, caring also takes dollars. You can help provide a home for these children with us by making a tax-deductible donation online at acch4kids.org or by calling us at 898-5520. 2020 has been a challenge for all of us. Our children are growing up in a safe and secure Christian home because of your generous support. At this critical time, we need your support now more than ever. We receive no state or federal funding. Please consider a year-end donation to help us continue to provide a loving home for our children. Go to acch4kids.org and click on the Donate Now button or call us at 898-5520.
Imagine this. A simple farmyard animal can change the lives of a family in Asia. Here is GFA founder and president KP O'Hannon to explain the Critter Campaign.
We started a thing called Critter Campaign years ago, and I'm so glad we did that, to celebrate Christmas by giving a gift to the poorest and the neediest and the most forgotten people in many countries in the Asian nations.
Join the GFA Critter Campaign. Go to the Critter Campaign banner on KNKT.com. Now, more of the rich history of the Critter Campaign from KP O'Hannon.
First year, we were able to give it to a couple of thousand families, gifts such as chickens and goats and buffaloes and sewing machines. And our objective was this gift we are giving in the name of Jesus.
Include a needy family in Asia on your Christmas list this year. Join the GFA Critter Campaign. Take part at KNKT.com. Go to the Critter banner at KNKT.com. Recent research has found that Google searches for the word prayer have surged worldwide alongside the spread of the novel coronavirus. In fact, Google Trends data shows that the search intensity for prayer doubles for every 8,000 COVID-19 cases. But is there a right way or a more effective way to pray? Here's best-selling author Kay Arthur.
Where the battle's raging, we're to be on the front lines. On the front lines on our knees, on the front lines standing in the full armor of God.
Kay's book, Lord, Teach Me to Pray in 28 Days, offers simple but powerful instruction on how and what to pray and what to expect when you do. And it's our way to say thank you when you give a gift of $25 or more today to help keep this ministry on the air. Give online securely at connectwithskip.com/offer or call 800-922-1888.
You're listening to KNKT. Welcome back to ABQ Connect with Jim Williams.
Author Ace Collins is visiting with us this afternoon, and I can't help but think, Ace, that you have a secret agent name, Ace Collins. And you're writing action adventure stories in between all of these Christmas books.
Yeah, we, you know, the real name is Andrew. I was playing hearts at Baylor when I was a student at Baylor and won the University Hearts Championship by playing an ace of hearts on a run to win the tournament. And I got the name Ace after that. And so and never could escape it. So it stuck with me. You know, I think the songs so fascinate me and the stories behind them are so unique that you just honestly remember them. And I think the impact that knowing that those stories behind those songs has meant to me and has meant to my appreciation of the music has really cemented them in my head. As far as research, oh gosh, separating the legend from fact has been the most difficult thing because, you know, originally the story of Silent Night was the mice ate the bellows in the organ. No, it was just an old organ. So you had to wade through that and find multiple sources as to where, so you could get the real story. If you look at a song like Away in the Manger, there are pageants in Germany that show Martin Luther singing that song to his children because, and it's called Luther's Cradle Hymn. Actually, it was written 200 or 300 years after Luther died in the United States, likely by an unknown Pennsylvania farmer, because that's where it first surfaced. And so, It's kind of separating what is fact and what is fiction. And I think that's one of the biggest challenges, but it's part of the most fun. Let's look at, you know, let's take a song that gave us Christmas traditions, because you mentioned traditions. Mm-hmm. Let's go back to 1840 in the United States. We're going to Medford, Massachusetts. And on the week before Thanksgiving, a young man is given a task by his preacher father. We're having a community Thanksgiving service. I want you to write a song for the children's choir. This man has writer's block. He can't think of anything. And he is working on the song, and he keeps hearing voices coming from outside. He goes outside, and he observes a bunch of teenage boys trying to impress teenage girls by seeing who can win races in horse-drawn sleighs. What this amounts to is a drag race in horse-drawn sleighs. It so inspires him, he goes back inside and he writes a song. That song is performed by the children's choir that Thanksgiving, and it's so popular, people request it at the community Christmas gathering a month later. Well, there are people from New York and there are people from Boston that are visiting at Christmas who hear that song and think it's a Christmas song, and they take it back and they teach it to people, and suddenly the song Jingle Bells becomes the song that is most identified with an American Christmas. As a matter of fact, it inspired people like Currier and Ives to do their artwork. It has taken on a life of its own, because even though only 70% of the country does not get snow at Christmas, most Christmases, we can't think of Christmas without snow, without sleds, without jingle bells, without all the things that are in that song. And what I find the most amusing about it all is that this song was inspired by a bunch of teenagers drag racing sleds, so it's really an 1840s Beach Boy song, if you think about it.
Absolutely. Trying to pick up girls by dashing through the snow.
Through the snow, yeah. And so here is this song that did that, and it really has created the image of Christmas all over the planet. Even in Australia, where it's summer, they think of Christmas the way that we do, with horse-drawn sleighs and jingle bells and everything else. Another funny kind of postscript to that story is that two writers from New England who were living in New Orleans wrote a kind of a follow-up song, and it was about them riding in sleighs when they were kids, riding in horse-drawn sleighs when they were kids. And they called the song Jingle Bell Rock. Well, Jingle Bell Rock became a huge hit for Bobby Helms. It was his signature song in Christmas music, and it's kind of made him immortal in that respect. But the funny thing is, when it came out, the two writers were appalled that people thought it was a rock and roll song, because if you listen to the lyrics, it's about it's about guys riding in sleds, and they're bouncing along in sleds. They're rocking in sleds. It has nothing to do with dance music. And they were kind of appalled by the fact that this had happened until the royalty checks started coming in. And then suddenly they liked the fact that they had written a rock and roll song without meaning to write a rock and roll song. So, you know, part of it's just luck. Part of it is Bing Crosby having a meeting with Irving Berlin, and Berlin giving him the music for Holiday Inn, the famous, you know, Hollywood. It's seen as a Christmas movie now, but really it's a movie that embraces all the holidays.
Yes.
And Berlin told him, I have written some incredible music for this, but the Christmas song is just not very good. I'll play it for you, but I'll write you something better. Berlin played the song he had written for Bing Crosby, and Crosby said, don't change a thing. Crosby was planning on releasing White Christmas in 1942. He was not planning on singing it till then, because Holiday Inn was not going to come out until the summer of 1942. And then Pearl Harbor happened, and Bing Crosby had a national radio show that happened to air that week on Christmas Eve. And at that network show, he thought it was appropriate to premiere White Christmas for the very first time. And I think because it was premiered at a point where there was so much insecurity in the world, and we were wondering, would our troops come back that were leaving? Would we win the war? Were we going to survive? That White Christmas made the impact it did because of the time it was released. I'm not sure it would have had that impact 3 or 4 years earlier or in 1952. But because it was Christmas Eve, 1941, people heard that song for the first time, and phone lines at the network lit up, demanding to hear it again and again and again. And that song, White Christmas, probably defines an American Christmas as we know it better than any song ever written. 2 years later, by the way, he released a song inspired by a man who was homesick he was at college and homesick for the girl who was back home, and he wrote 12 lines called I'll Be Home for Christmas, and you could imagine what that meant in World War II as well, and Crosby had the hit on that as well. The line in that song that confuses everyone is, and presents on the tree, not under the tree, but remember, before we got electric trains and other things that were common gifts, presents were small enough you could wrap them in a package and tie them on trees, and people would untie them and then unwrap the package on Christmas Day. Yeah. And so that's the line that's so interesting there. Judy Garland was the next Christmas hit during World War II with Have Yourself a Merry Little Christmas. She refused to record the song initially or put it in the movie Meet Me in St. Louis because it had somewhat negative lyrics. You know, this may be Christmas last, next year we may be living in the past was what the songwriters wrote originally, which fit the movie. Mm. But Judy wouldn't record those lyrics because so many people were so insecure during World War II, and they changed it to be upbeat lyrics. And it became her best-selling song of all time, beating even Somewhere Over the Rainbow. And then the last song, written in 1944 on the hottest day of the year in Hollywood, was a song penned by Mel Torme and Robert Wells. They were hot. They were trying to be writing music for a Hollywood musical. They couldn't find any inspiration. They were sweating. They were drinking lemonade. And Mel Torme started talking about growing up in New England and how he wished it was winter again, and he wished he was there. Robert Wells had grown up there as well, and they just started talking about things they remembered from their childhood, and talking about chestnuts roasting on an open fire and Jack Frost nipping at your nose inspired a song that they wrote in 20 minutes. They had a large discussion on who they were going to take the song to. Wells wanted to take it to Crosby. Torme wanted to take the song to Nat King Cole. And Torme won somehow. And Wells was not happy at the time because he realized that there were many places that would not play Nat King Cole's music because he was black. And in Christmas 1944, Nat King Cole made Christmas a lot more colorful by having the very first Christmas hit introduced by an African-American on the American Hit Parade. And ironically enough, the song was so good that it was played in the South, in the Southwest, in the North, the Midwest, and the East. And the fact that Nat King Cole was black didn't matter. He integrated music before Jackie Robinson integrated baseball or before Rosa Parks took a seat on a bus. So we owe Nat King Cole and then Mel Torme's insistence that Nat record that song. That's an important part of American history, as well as being one of the landmark Christmas songs of all time.
It's great history, Ace. Ace Collins is the author of over 99 books, 2.5 million copies sold. You can tell by his presentation that he knows this information inside out. But more than anything, Ace, I'm hearing you talk about things that you really love talking about. We need to take a quick break, but when we come back, we got another 15 minutes with Ace. Stay with us on ABQ Connect.
Serving you and your family.
Locally grown, locally owned. Bosca Heating and Cooling. A portion goes back into the community. 444-7200.
For quality service like a breath of fresh air, call Bosca and we'll be there.
Listen to this hotspot as Skip Heitzig shares a lesson about owning your faith.
So he is mentored by this priest. He becomes king himself. Joash, Jehoash. So now you have a politician
with a godly background.
He does what is right in the sight of the Lord.
The story doesn't end there.
But his righteousness only lasts while his mentor lasts. When his mentor dies, when the priest dies, he starts taking on the values of the people around him.
Find more from Skip at connectwithskip.com.
Your faith is only propped up by others. You will stumble when those props are gone.
Now this from Skip about deep roots.
You need to come to a place where you build your own roots, man, and you stand before God yourself, man or woman of God, and you are getting the strength directly from the Holy Spirit so that when they die or if they fall or something happens, your faith is not shaken. Your faith is not shaken.
You're in a crisis when you don't know what to do.
That's Tony Evans, who says your past does not need to be your future. And his book, Your Comeback, is a gift from Star 88 and KNKT this month when you make a donation to help us meet our end-of-the-year budget. Just give a gift at star88.fm or knkt.com. Click under Donate, and you'll be helping our stations make the end-of-the-year budget.
What is the master key that can give you hope about a reversal in your circumstances? Simply stated, the master key for the reversal of consequences brought on by sin is developing a lifestyle of repentance.
Get your copy of Your Comeback now. Make a donation at star88.fm or knkt.com. Click under Donate to receive Tony Evans' book, Your Comeback.
Why training camp really matters. This is Roger Patterson with a minute of Vision for Life. Training camp is in the spring for baseball, summer for football, and fall for basketball. Each of these sports has a time of training, and the first few days are the hardest. It's in those first few days where coaches are able to see what they have to work with and where they need to work and focus over the next few weeks. Players who come to camp out of shape are especially criticized. A few years back, much was made out of Albert Haynesworth's inability to pass his conditioning test because he was out of shape. Training camps are crucibles for athletes. You know, we experience our own training camps as we go through challenging seasons that shape and mold our character. The scripture tells us that God doesn't waste these seasons. Proverbs 24:4 states, "Take away the dross from the silver, and the smith has material for a vessel." Sometimes we have to have the rust knocked off so that God has something to work with.
You've been listening to Dr. Roger Patterson with A Minute of Vision, a ministry of Vision for Life Radio.
This week on Connect with Skip Hytek, Skip explains your future experience in heaven.
In heaven, the presence of God, far different than it is now for us. Yes, God is present with us now, but in heaven, the presence of God will be direct, visible, unmitigated, unfiltered. We'll be directly in His presence.
Connect with Skip Hytek every day this week as he continues the series 2020.
Weekdays at 8 a.m. on KNKT. You're listening to KNKT. Welcome back to ABQ Connect with Jim Williams.
Be sure and contact Indigo Mortgage for a quote when you are shopping for your next mortgage, maybe refinancing, maybe purchasing a home. Call 836-5700 or reach them on the web at indigomortgage.net. Indigo Mortgage, because nobody cares more about your mortgage loan. Author Ace Collins is visiting with us this afternoon. And I don't know if I said this earlier, but Merry Christmas, Ace. You're giving us all of this great information about the beautiful Christmas carols that we've sung for many years, not knowing any of this fantastic history. And I want to address history right now with all of the revisionist things we've been hearing, with all of the anti-American sentiment. We've had crazy race relations. And you just mentioned something really special to me about how Nat King Cole would have been the very first black musician to sing a Christmas carol. And it ended up being so appealing and so wonderful that people in the South and people that would be known for discriminating against blacks really received it and brought it in. And I just kind of see that this is woven into the fabric of American history.
Well, if you look at Christmas music, it defines a lot of what was going on in the world once you know the song story behind it. You can actually see snapshots of American history. The song Little Drummer Boy was written and influenced by a piano teacher who was a professor at Wellesley College at the time, Wellesley University now. And she saw people in the Great Depression who were incredibly impoverished, who didn't even have the money to buy their children and grandchildren a present. And she watched that suffering that was going on. And it inspired her to create Little Drummer Boy. The song would actually linger for about 20 years before it was a hit. But Little Drummer Boy is, in a way, a snapshot of the Great Depression. And can you imagine being those parents? And by the way, my grandparents were two of those parents who did not have the money to buy their children Christmas presents, not even an orange or a pair of socks. And what would have been like to have suffered through those times as both parents and children? There was a sadness in my father that kind of haunted him his entire life. He was an incredibly successful person, but he never got over being that poor hillbilly who had to climb on a truck as a five-year-old kid and go to California and watch his parents suffer and trying to find any kind of job they could find. And so in Christmas, he always told me it was the most horrible time for all of them, you know. And so, you know, there were millions who felt that way in Christmas. So when you think of Little Drummer Boy, realize that was inspired by the poverty that was a part of the Great Depression. You look at a song like Do You Hear What I Hear, which was a huge hit in the early 1960s, it was inspired by two things. One, the concentration camps of Germany in World War II. A man named Noel, who had been in those camps and then come to the United States as an immigrant, speaking no English, by the way, hoping to make it here in the late 50s, the first place he walked into was a hotel to get a room, and playing a piano at that hotel was a woman that he literally fell in love with at first sight. He could not speak English. She could not speak French. But within a month, they were engaged. Mm-hmm. They fell in love that way. And they started writing songs together. And one of the most incredible songs they wrote was inspired by the war in Vietnam, and also inspired by what this man had witnessed in concentration camps and witnessed in World War II. And the song is, "Do You Hear What I Hear?" And it was such a monster song in the early 60s, and it was so haunting that people would actually pull their cars off the side of the road just to listen to it when they heard it the first time. I also find it really interesting to note that the names of the songwriters, the man and the woman, were Noel and Gloria. Mm. And that just makes the fact that they wrote this incredible Christmas song, you know, all that more interesting. The interview with Gloria about that song was one of the best interviews I've ever had an opportunity to do in my entire life. But it was a part of the haunting of the experience of World War II and also the Vietnam War.
Yeah.
And, you know, those are things that impact songwriters, and songwriters write about what they feel and what they experience. And if it takes the singers, though, to bring that experience to life, because, you know, they're the vessel that carries that tune. And therefore, without Bing Crosby having latched on to the real emotion in "I'll Be Home for Christmas," which defined World War II as well as any song that was probably ever penned. Mm-hmm. You know, we would not probably have had that song still being sung and have been recorded by hundreds upon hundreds of different artists over the last 70 years.
Now, are you envisioning that there's going to be a rap artist current day that comes up with a Christmas song that everybody's going to be rapping to here in 20 years?
I don't know. You know, that's an interesting thought. You know, I don't think when Mariah Carey's song came out that has become such a monster, I would have ever expected it to last. I thought when you looked at Mark Lowry's "Mary, Did You Know," I thought it was brilliant because he wrote a carol that was from a totally different point of view than any point of view that had ever been used before. But I don't know that he would have... it took him 2 years to even find music for it. I don't think he ever expected it to be the monster hit that it was. And when Kathy Mattea latched onto it and made it a hit, she didn't expect it to be a big hit either. Mm-hmm. You know, I don't think when Frank Pooler wrote mid 1940s, a song about not being able to be with somebody he loved, that it would ever be recorded. And then in the 1960s, when he was a professor at Cal State University, and you had this student that had a trio that performed at local Holiday Inns and stuff, he gave the student this song and said, "Hey, you may want to sing this song during the holidays." And the student taught it to his sister, and they sang it, and it became, you know, the Carpenters' Christmas song that you hear each and every year. So I don't think, I wouldn't rule out there being a song that kids rap to. And I think if it survives, it'll be probably more along the lines of Jingle Bells and other songs that are probably children oriented. It'll have to be something that evokes the childlike spirit in people, but it's possible. Mm-hmm. I mean, the irony though, if you think about it, really for music to survive, it has to be universal in the nature of it has to appeal to generation after generation. And you think about how little big band music has survived with Christmas themes.
Yes.
You know, so I think it almost has to be popular music that transcends time to be a popular Christmas song. Now, with Christmas carols, you know, it's kind of a different thing. Christmas carols have to evoke a message that with that appeals not to individuals, because Christmas songs, we like them or we don't. Christmas carols, though, are corporate in nature, and so they have to work in a church setting. And so, therefore, their ability to appeal to us is much different than the ability of or the demographic appeal of a Christmas song like White Christmas.
Is there any economic difference between how much money a Christmas carol or a religious song generates as compared to a Christmas song?
I think so. I mean, you know, a Christmas song has the potential to make tens of millions of dollars to a songwriter in this day and time. Heaven knows how much Irving Berlin has made off White Christmas over the years, or Johnny Marks has made off his three monster hits. You know, Gene Autry writing that little song that he did when he was writing in the Hollywood Christmas parade of 1946, he thought everybody was excited to see him back from the service and then realized the kids were pointing to Santa Claus behind him, and he wrote "Here Comes Santa Claus." You know, obviously Gene Autry was kind of a struggling actor at that particular point, you know, making a pretty good living, but not a great living. He wrote, you know, he wrote that song and recorded it, and then wrote Rudolph the Red-Nosed, or didn't write Rudolph the Red-Nosed Reindeer, but recorded Johnny Marks' song, Rudolph the Red-Nosed Reindeer, and suddenly ends up owning a professional baseball team. And so, you know, that made him more money than all of the movies put together. So I think having a song makes a tremendous impact. The priest who wrote Silent Night never got a penny off of it. So carols, by and large, even Mary Did You Know, do not have the power that a song played everywhere around the world on a secular radio station is going to have.
Yeah.
So if you're going, you know, if you're in it for the money alone, you've got all these people trying to write that next great Christmas song. And really, there's only about one or two a generation that last. I mean, think about this. I mean, Blue Christmas was written in 1946. Mm-hmm. It had been a minor hit for Ernest Tubb in country music. Hugo Wintergarten and his orchestra had recorded it first in big band. But it wasn't a hit that was making, you know, the songwriter, who was a jingle writer, much money. And then Elvis took it into the studio. And Elvis actually didn't want to record it. He thought it was Ernest Tubb's song, and he knew Ernest, and he didn't want to steal Ernest Tubb's song. And he didn't want RCA to release it. And so he put this weird background, this woo-woo-woo background, and then with a high vocal by Kathy Westmoreland, I believe. No, it was before Kathy Westmoreland. Millie Kirkland would have been doing his high vocals back then, female vocals. And he put that in there thinking the record company wouldn't release it. And ironically enough, it was that background and that weird arrangement that made that song a lasting hit. And we can't imagine Christmas without hearing that woo-woo to this day, and that Elvis Presley hit. And that song, that album that song is on, has gone double diamond in sales. And that is, nobody does that.
Yeah.
And yet that Christmas album continues to do that. By the way, Elvis's favorite Christmas song was one that was written specifically for him. And I think it's one of the best Christmas songs ever written that no one knows, or a few people know, and that is "Why Can't Every Day Be Like Christmas?" I think that is a profound song. And probably the greatest country music song that's a Christmas hit, Roy Orbison cut it in Rock and Roll, was Willie Nelson's song, "Pretty Paper." And everybody thinks it's a love song. You mentioned listening to lyrics for the first time.
Yes.
Go back and listen to the lyrics of that song. That song is talking about a homeless guy on the street that everybody passes by and pays no attention to. It is Charles Dickens' Christmas Carol set in, you know, in a verse and a chorus. And it is amazing, and it's almost chilling when you hear lyrics like, "Should I stop? Better not. Much too busy. I'm in a hurry. My, how time does fly. In the distance, the ringing of laughter. And in the midst of the laughter, he cries." That is profound.
That is. And heartbreaking.
Oh, it is heartbreaking. And yet, you know, we pass people by every year at Christmas that we don't notice, because we are so caught up in the rush of Christmas that we miss everything else. And perhaps this year, when my family's not getting together because of Christmas — I actually lost an aunt 3 weeks ago to COVID. Obviously, she won't be there, even if her family could have gotten together. She was just 76 and in good health. It just, it went through her and just killed her within a couple of weeks. But when you're looking at COVID and what it's doing in the way of separation, the inability to go to services and do shopping like normal and things like that, you have an opportunity this year that you've never had before, and that is to sit back and actually quietly count your blessings.
Yes.
And that's what I've done, and I think it has made the daughter and the two sons, who I won't be seeing, mean that much more to me. You know, and it'll also make Christmas next year that much more special. Mm-hmm. And we didn't get a chance much to talk about traditions today, but one of the great traditions of Christmas is Christmas cards that dates back to Great Britain in about 1850. Mm-hmm. Henry Cole started that tradition. The story behind it, you can read in the book. It's a funny story in some ways, but what I do with 160 Christmas cards I send out every year is I write, if you're getting my Christmas card, you mean something to me. Mm. It's not just I'm sending out Christmas cards. And so what I do is I actually write 4 or 5 or 6 lines in each card reminding that person who's getting that card why they're getting it, what they did that impacted my life, how they changed my life, something they did that inspired me, something like that. So my Christmas cards are also thank you notes for the impact that people have had in my life. And I somehow think that those Christmas cards this year will mean more than they ever have before, because I know the Christmas cards I'm getting do, because we have the time this year to actually look at them and study them and read the words that are inside them. And so even if they arrive late, I encourage all our listeners to write a Christmas card, even if it's after Christmas, and mail it telling somebody out there how much you appreciate the love and the support and the inspiration they've given you in your life.
Absolutely. How have you been inspired during COVID? Are you more motivated on the action-adventure side of writing, or are you writing something else sentimental and Christmassy?
Well, I write one nonfiction book a year, so I've been working on a nonfiction book that will be released in 2022. But I wrote a novel and gave it to my agent, and he'll shop it early this year, that I think is the best thing I've ever written. So I've used the time to write. There's no doubt about that. But I've also used the time to get in touch with people I hadn't been in touch with in a long time and make calls to people who I don't get to see and ask how they're doing. So, in a way, at a time when I'm more isolated than ever before, you know, I didn't get to experience it like my wife did. My wife was actually at a university where people paid attention to protocols, and they made it through the entire semester. She made it through there as a professor. But the kids that we have, the people that I know, we didn't get an opportunity to visit with in the normal way. So I've used it to text. I've used it to call. I've used it to do things like that. And that has, you know, made me appreciate these holidays a great deal more than I would have otherwise. And I don't feel like I've wasted the time. I also decorated my yard even more than I do normally do. And my yard normally looks like Disneyland Central. And so, because I think people are going to be out looking at decorations and seeing things that they don't normally see.
Yeah.
And so when you think about your holidays this year, and the holidays continue, I mean, you know, the Orthodox Church doesn't celebrate Christmas till January 6th. And by the way, the 12 days of Christmas start on the 25th and go through the 6th, mm-hmm. The way that it's actually thought of in the real 12 days of Christmas. You still have an opportunity to make an impact at Christmas and do some things that you may not get to hug people or kiss people, but you will still get to make an impact in their life by simply doing something and leaving it on the doorstep or making a call or writing that card. And I think that is probably the best use of time that we have in 2021. And it sets up in a way how much more personal, but also how much brighter the holidays will be in 2022.
Yeah. Well, I am, like you, just encouraged by the written word. And I think you're absolutely right. Blessing somebody with a card or a letter and telling them why they're special and important to you is an amazing blessing. And I so much appreciate you, Ace, spending the time with us today, and I want to wish you a Merry Christmas, and love to have you back on the show and talk more about even some of your action adventure novels when you have time.
I look forward to it, and not just have a Merry Christmas, but have a mighty Christmas.
A mighty Christmas. Amen. Appreciate you so much. We'll talk to you soon.
ABQ Connect is presented by Bosky Heating and Cooling. For service, call 504-444-7200. Bosky Heating and Cooling, locally grown, locally owned. ABQ Connect with Jim Williams is a production of KNKT. The views expressed on ABQ Connect do not necessarily reflect the views of the staff or management of KNKT. If you missed any or part of today's show, get the free podcast at abqconnect.online.